This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
We would like to now go to our next speaker or speakers. This will be a team effort from Disability Voices United. Judy Mark has an adult son with autism who practices supported decision-making. As the president of Disability Voices United, Judy led the coalition to pass the supported decision-making law in 2022. Miguel Lugo is an outreach specialist for Disability Voices United with cerebral palsy who practices supported decision-making. Miguel's goals align with the mission statement of DVU, which is to empower the disability community with the knowledge, experience, and encouragement of their given rights. Vivian Doe is the project manager for DVU's new Supported Decision-Making Training and Information Center, where she provides trainings throughout the state for self-advocates, family members, and professionals. Vivian brings her experiences as a family member and working with people with IDD in using supported decision-making in their daily lives. Thank you very much.
Hi, all. Welcome to our presentation today on supported decision making in healthcare settings. So thank you so much, John, for introducing us. And we'll go ahead and get started with our presentation today.
Good afternoon, everyone. Regardless of our disabilities or what support we need, we all have a right to make our own choices.
So we wanted to start off with that quote to kind of frame what we want to be discussing today, which is all about supported decision making. And so we're going to start off with a brief introduction to what supported decision making is, and then go into talking about how helping healthcare providers understand how supported decision making is used in the healthcare setting, how it's used otherwise. And then we'll go into more practical examples about using supported decision making, providing stories from a self-advocate, from a parent's perspective, as well as sharing, again, practical examples of how you can implement supported decision-making and help support others. And so we'll start with, what is supported decision-making? All of us use supported decision-making every day, whether it's calling a friend to get a second opinion on a medical issue, calling your friend who's a doctor to ask for advice about it. Maybe it's calling a family member for help to use the computer. We all are using supported decision-making every day. And so in supported decision-making, the person with a disability or self-advocate chooses supporters to help them make decisions. These supporters help them understand, consider, and communicate their choices and preferences. And so supported decision-making can be a very informal process, like I just said, but it can also be written into more formal documents, which we'll mention later, into a supported decision-making agreement, as well as implemented with other forms as well. But one of the big things that we want to emphasize with supported decision-making is it's designed to change as life changes. Unlike conservatorship, which is the supported decision-making is the alternative to, you don't have to go to the court to change anything. If the self-advocate changes their mind and wants to change their supporter, how much support they get or when they get support, that's a simple process of having a conversation with their supporters. It's designed to change as life changes. And that's one of the big benefits of using supported decision-making. And so I'll hand it off to Miguel to continue talking about the advantages of it.
Yes, some advantages of supported decision making is you can expand your circle of support. If during your lifespan you meet someone that you really trust, you can include them into your supported decision making team. Supports without cords. You don't have to involve the cords in your decisions, especially when it comes to your personal health care. The last thing that we want to involve is the cords. The cords do not know us personally. They don't know who we are. They don't know what we like, what we don't like. So they have no reason to be involved in our healthcare choices. The flexibility to change our minds. I don't know anyone that locks into a decision for life. We each change our minds constantly. So as adults living with disabilities, we should have that same right as well. And of course, we can always combine supported decision making with other legal documents as well, if I myself feel the need to do so.
Hi, everybody. This is Judy Mark. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how supported decision making came into law in the state of California. So it was passed by a broad coalition of organizations back in 2022. And it was through a bill that was called Assembly Bill 1663, which is now written into the Welfare and Institutions Code, saying that supported decision making must be accepted by a range of sources such as schools, healthcare providers, legal lawyers, in many different settings and financial settings at banks, that a supported decision making agreement must be accepted, and that people who you practice supported decision making have a right to have their supporters in various settings, such as the doctor's office. There is still a lot, not a lot of knowledge about supported decision making in this state. One of the reasons why we're working on this, but because there isn't knowledge of it, there have been many reports to us that people with a disability, let's say they're turning 18 and they're in school and they want to have their mother and father in their IEP with them, that the school district is saying, no, you cannot do that. That's actually illegal. It's written very clearly in the law that a third party, like a school or a doctor's office or a bank, may not refuse the presence of supporters who are when the person with a disability is practicing supported decision making. So this is still me. So there's a range of other kinds of ways to practice supported decision making in healthcare that look much more like substitute decision making than supported decision making. So let me try to explain the difference. So supported decision making is going into a doctor's office and the doctor saying to the person with the disability, you need to have a procedure for an illness or something that is wrong with you. You need to have this procedure and you need to give us consent to this procedure. And the person with a disability in supported decision making, it would look like getting the information, maybe not understanding the information, but having your supporter explain it in a way that you understand. And then the person themselves independently making that decision with support. So it might look like somebody coming in and somebody saying to you, you are very sick, you need your appendix removed. And so the individual could understand, like, I don't want to have the surgery. What is this about? And their support is saying, you will be out of pain. Like, this is a really good thing. Even though it's going to be hard at the beginning, this will make your pain go away. But you have to understand what the risks are, but you also have to understand the benefits. And then this person saying, okay, after hearing this information, I will communicate that, or I want you, mom or dad or friend, to communicate that to the healthcare provider. But there are people out there who may not either want to use supported decision making in a healthcare setting, or maybe they lack full capacity in making complex healthcare decisions. And so this is where many individuals are willing to go into a substitute decision making arrangement. So one of the sort of the main way, and I'm sure any of you who are in the audience who work in the healthcare field, you understand what the durable healthcare power of attorney process is. So first of all, I should say that every adult should have a durable healthcare power of attorney, regardless of whether you have a disability. I have a durable healthcare power of attorney with my husband, so that if for some reason I cannot make my own healthcare decisions, I'm unconscious, I'm unable to really process information, my husband can step in for that one decision and be able to make use durable healthcare power of attorney. It only kicks in when the person lacks capacity to make their own decisions, right? So there's also a brand new law that just went into effect called the Next of Kin Law, which is in California. And it allows the healthcare provider on a one-time basis to find someone who understands the individual with the disabilities situation. They understand their sort of desires. And in that one-time situation, the healthcare provider could say, all right, you're here. You don't have durable healthcare power of attorney, but you are here in this situation, here, and let's say there's a car accident. Can you give permission for this individual to have this procedure or this operation? Another quick couple of ways that you can use substitute decision making is that you can get what's called a HIPAA authorization or a release of information. So the person with a disability can sign a HIPAA authorization, which allows the person that they choose, whether it's a family member or a friend, the person that they choose to be able to access medical records and without the person's being there. And they're also able to have phone conversations with healthcare providers without the individual being there. There's also, all of you must know about the advanced medical directives, which you have a discussion with the individual, like what do you want at the end of your life? And that advanced medical directive can kick in if that is required.
Now we'll also go into talking about practicing supported decision making with different types of communicators, whether they're not speaking, they're a typer, they use alternative, augmented alternative communication. One of the big things we want to talk about is having customized tools that are available to help them communicate and understand their choices, having access to that communication technology, whether it's something very high tech, such as an iPad, allowing them to type out their choices, or a choice board, whether that's on an iPad or in a non-digital format, allowing them to communicate their choices, how they're feeling. And so we'll include in the chat at the end of our session here examples of these types of communication boards, especially in the healthcare setting, whether it's a pain scale that is in very plain language, examples of pointing out where an injury may be, where they're feeling hurt, different medical issues that they may be having, and using images and plain language to allow them to be able to have an accessible conversation about how they're feeling and being a part of their healthcare communication process. Especially when it goes into considering getting informed consent from individuals, we again want to emphasize having plain language, visual or audio materials, and allowing that to cater to how they process the information. Also encouraging them to have trained communication partners to allow them to support and facilitate their conversation as needed. And so these are just some strategies. And again, we'll share at the end a packet of tools that can be used if the individual is non-speaking, but ensuring that the self-advocate is able to understand their choices fully before they're able to make their decision, helping them understand the pros and cons in whatever format is best for them. Again, whether it's visual, audio, watching a video, and allowing them time to process these conversations, whether it's giving them time beforehand to really process it and preparing for the meeting, having their supporters, whether it's the physician, a part of their support team, or their parents, having a conversation with them beforehand, before the meeting, helping them prepare to ask questions at the visit, as well as giving them time after, letting them know that they don't need to be rushed into a decision, allowing them time to really process everything that is going on. And next, we'll go into talking more about some practical examples, sharing some stories about practicing supported decision making, and giving some examples as well.
Yes. So when I prepare to go in to see my doctor, I like to process. I like to know what's going to happen. I like to process it. So not only so that I can mentally prepare for it, but so that I can let the doctor know what's going to work and what's not. I'll give you an example. A couple of months ago, my doctor sent me to a specialist. That specialist, then I met with that specialist once, and that specialist sent me in to get an MRI. Mind you, I live with cerebral palsy. As soon as I got to the doctor's office to prepare to take my MRI, they stuck me in that tube. And then the technician told me, you're going to have to stay completely still for 15 to 20 minutes. I don't know about you guys, but if you have ever met somebody with cerebral palsy, yeah, that's not gonna go very well. Had the specialist informed me of a process, I would have let him know that that wasn't gonna work and we could have came to a different conclusion, a different alternative. In talking with the technician, we figured out that a CAT scan would work much better. So I had to go back to the specialist and get an authorization for that CAT scan, which I still have not been able to get done. So we could have saved each other about 2.5 months worth of wasted time had I had been made aware of a process of procedures and then informed him that that was not going to work. So yes, it's very important that we share processes and procedures and receive that feedback as to what may not work and what may work, because we are the lived experience professionals.
Thank you, Miguel, for sharing that story. And in regards to having those tools and providing information on how, what types of procedures work best, or those strategies, again, we'll share at the end later, this healthcare passport that can be really helpful to help facilitate understanding someone's healthcare needs, and giving kind of a brief history about what their healthcare needs are, how they communicate as a person, how they show different, whether it's pain, and what else. And so now we just want you to think about and consider some strategies to help a patient make an informed decision on whether or not they would like to receive an optional vaccination or optional procedure. And so I give the example of when working as a caregiver, someone I worked with, They needed to get a TB test as well as their flu shot in order to participate fully in this internship that they wanted to do to be able to work with animals. They could participate in the internship without having their vaccinations and getting a TB test, but they wouldn't be able to fully work with and interact with the animals, which is what they wanted to do. And so we went about it different ways. We talked about getting the flu shot and how that can help mitigate what symptoms you may have later on and protect you against the flu. We also talked about how getting your tuberculosis test makes sure that you, your fellow interns, as well as the animals are safe. But to them, that wasn't what was really centering them on this decision. So it's all about making them consider and communicate, consider things from their point of view and thinking about what is important to them, and being able to explain the pros and cons in a way that's informative to them and makes them want to be a part of the decision-making process. So what I found for them was the big motivator was wanting to participate with the animals and wanting to be able to take part in this internship with the animals. And so that's how we were able to talk about the pros and the cons. And the pro is that you're going to be able to fully work with these animals that you really wanted to work with, the lizards, the cats at the store. And then the cons would be if you didn't take it, that you wouldn't be able to fully participate in this program you really like. And these The way we center the pros and cons and helping explain these types of procedures is really important when we're talking about a self-advocate. We really want to center them when we're explaining these choices to them, explaining it in a way that they understand. And this pertains to a bunch of different healthcare procedures, whether it's talking about the healthy lifestyle decisions, about making healthy eating habits as well, centering it in a way that is important to them.
Mine? I think so. I think that, you know, it the way that you would want to work with a patient to inform them about a more, you know, something a little bigger than like getting blood taken or getting your teeth cleaned, you know, that's something like that's getting your, it's something like getting your appendix out or some other really significant procedure. Is somewhat individualized. I know I've seen some stuff coming in the chat and some questions like what's the best practice on this? So we at Disability Voices United rarely use the term best practice. And the reason we don't use it is it becomes a bit robotic in its implementation. So if the best practice is, you know, drawing a picture of a human body and pointing out X's on the places where you have problems, or maybe using, you know, touching the person's body or touching your own body to show them. I mean, these are all what people would call best practices, but they're not necessarily the best practice for my son. So I have a 28-year-old son who practices supported decision making. He has autism and intellectual disabilities and requires 24/7 support. If I touched my body or touched his body, it would not necessarily work for him, even though it's a best practice. Drawing a picture may or may help, may not help either. So I believe that you need to understand each individual's way that they learn. Like what is their learning strategy for anything, and modify your strategy on getting informed consent to that person's abilities, right? So strength-based here, not the best practice, but I would say the best practice is to make it individualized, right? So, so obviously the person who's helping try to get that informed consent has got to be a trusted individual, as Vivian talked about at the beginning. Supporters must be trusted. And that means they must know the person pretty well. So getting informed consent from a nurse who's a total stranger to the individual may not work. You know, I've heard stories of people with autism who have diabetes, Many people who are taking psychotropic medications end up overweight and with diabetes. And so this is a really common thing that we see, is that they have, health, really significant health problems because maybe they're not getting their diabetes under control. And I've heard a story about a man who needed to have his foot amputated because of his diabetes and would absolutely refuse to give consent to the procedure. And it took many different tries to try to get the information to him in a way that he understood and could relate to. And it took many different people and many different tries to finally get the consent so that he could live. If he didn't have his foot amputated, he would die. And so, these are very, very difficult tasks, but they're not as difficult when the person who's trying to get the informed consent knows that individual well, because they know how they learn, they know what motivates them, and how they communicate. And so my advice is that there are many, many different strategies. Try them out on the individual you support and see how they work, and choose the one that works the best.
Kind of going off of what Judy is saying, is talking about how to help providers understand and practice supported decision making. And like she was saying, it's not necessarily best practices, but these are some examples that you can implement and try and see if that's what works best for this individual patient. And so one of the big things, this is our support tip sheet. And so some examples of how providers can assist in using the supported decision making in healthcare settings, including presuming competence. A lot of self-advocates we talk about, we talk with, share stories about being in a doctor's office and the conversation is about them, but they don't feel included. No one is talking directly to them at these visits. They're talking to their supporters. So a big component of that is presuming competence and including them and making sure that they stay centered in these conversations. Other examples, like Judy mentioned before, is role-playing with visuals. Some tools that have helped providers I've seen in the past is something called tell, show, do. So telling them what the procedure is going to be, showing them in a way that is non-invasive or less invasive. So for dentistry, I'm going to use this and I'm going to count your teeth with it today. We're not going to do any other procedure. We're just going to, this is my teeth counter, and we're going to show it on the hand first. And now we're going to show it on your teeth. Nothing to be worried about. And then go into talking about what a comprehensive exam would look like there and building up those steps and role-playing it with them, whether it's role-playing with a mannequin or on your hand and demonstrating it in ways that are non-invasive to them. Other tools that we mentioned earlier is our healthcare passport. I'm sharing that here as well. And this packet I'm linking here also includes a pain sheet, as well as a choice board and an information board about where they might be feeling pain, whether they're coughing, whether they're hurt somewhere. And this healthcare passport just really gives a brief medical history about the individual. But one of the big things is talking about, if I'm in pain, I show it how. Maybe they don't show it. Maybe they have some verbal cue. Maybe they move their arm a certain way when they're in pain. Maybe they are touching the body part. And another big part is, if I get upset or distressed, this is the best way you can help me. And a lot of times in these healthcare settings, it can be a very overwhelming experience. So understanding how they respond when they're stressed is also important. And again, the link that we shared in the chat provides other resources as well, including the forms that Judy mentioned earlier, the HIPAA authorizations as well. And so these are just some examples that we wanted to share today and share some stories about using supported decision making in healthcare. And so right now here we have these QR codes, and the bottom one is our supported decision making handbook for parents, but it provides a lot of great resources to providers and self-advocates as well. And all of that shows, again, all of these practical examples, but also shows supported decision-making if you're interested in other settings, such as in finances and education as well. Again, we only touched on healthcare today because that's our focus here today. And then the link above, we also provided a training feedback form. We are providing these trainings from our grant from State Council of Developmental Disabilities to educate more people about supported decision making. And we would really appreciate it if you can fill that out for us as well.
Thank you so very much for a comprehensive discussion on supported decision making, especially for all the examples and cases. And so there are a number of questions, and I'll go with the first one, which actually came through the chat. So the question is, I'm a physician at Golden Gate Regional Center, so that's one of the regional centers. We have many unconserved clients, so I think this means clients who don't have conservatorship, which is an alternative, for whom we are expected to sign consents under WIC 4655. I think the directors of the regional centers are allowed to do this. How does this relate to our signing consents for procedures?
Yeah, great question. And I was going to mention it earlier, and I didn't, but thank you for bringing that up. So there's a couple of things in the Welfare and Institution Code that also allows other people besides supporters. So we have the next of kin law, which is for everybody, not just for people with disabilities. Then we have a provision in Welfare Institution Code that allows the regional center to make a decision about healthcare on a one-time basis. But then there's an additional provision in the Welfare and Institution Code that allows the State Council on Developmental Disabilities to make a one-time healthcare decision for somebody who is unconserved. And so I think the point is this, is that there are so many ways, from the next of kin law to these provisions about the regional center and the state council, to HIPAA authorization and durable healthcare power of attorney, that we believe makes it unnecessary for people to get conserved. And so while we're trying to advocate for supported decision making, we're not just advocating for it like in a vacuum. We're advocating for it to say that people who enter conservatorships lose all of their civil rights, and only people with disabilities are faced with that situation. You cannot conserve a person who's non-disabled. No matter what you've done in life, the most heinous crimes in the world, you still have more civil rights as a prisoner on death row than you do if you are a person with a disability who's under general conservatorship or who's under a limited conservatorship with all of their powers taken away. And so that, you know, I want folks to think about that there are many, many different ways to support a person, particularly in the healthcare setting.
With that healthcare setting, it's standard to see a patient alone for part of the visit in order to ask some sensitive questions or do a sensitive exam. How do you recommend balancing supported decision making with assuring confidentiality for patients with disabilities?
That's a harder question, I think. Because it is not about getting support for decisions. It is more about ensuring the person is making their own choices about who they want in the room during these private procedures. And so I don't think there's one answer. I think it's again, very individualized. I mean, if you have a person who's, let's say, having a pap smear, a woman who's having a pap smear, and you know, you want to be able to communicate with that individual in the best way that you can, to say, are you okay with being alone in the room with the doctor, or would you like someone with you the whole time? I mean, the reason why some people might want to have someone with them the whole time, even though it's a private procedure, is because they may use alternative types of communication, and perhaps it's a very uncomfortable procedure. They're in pain. You know, something happens during that time, and they cannot communicate to you exactly what's going on, and it's good to have a supporter in the room to be able to communicate that. I guess we would look at a deaf patient. If a deaf patient is coming in and having a private procedure or an exam done, but the doctor does not use sign language, what are you going to do in that circumstance, right? You're pretty much going to have an interpreter in the room so that they are understanding everything that's going to happen to them in that during that procedure. So I think of a supporter in a similar way. If the person needs that level of support for communication or for understanding or remaining calm, then they should be allowed to have a supporter in the room.
So it's a similar question, and this is for teenagers who usually between ages 12 and 18, there's a time in the visit where we ask those sensitive questions. And you would say that then we ought to ask the patient whether they would like us to ask the questions with, you know, alone or with somebody else in the room.
Yeah. So here's my caveat of having somebody in the room all, you know, if they have communication support. It's that you as a healthcare professional need to be able to assess independently on the health and safety of your patients, right? So I'll give an example of a real life case that wasn't in the healthcare setting, was more in the regional center setting, where an individual who was living in supported living got visits every quarter by her regional center. And it's a health and safety visit. That's why regional centers do it. It's similar to the health and safety that a doctor would assess. But every single time the regional center came, the service provider was there every single time, 100% of the time. And several years went on where it was revealed that this person was being starved to death by her service provider. And the fact that there wasn't that alone time that the regional center got with a person who, by the way, was able to communicate, but was terrified. You know, you want to be able to have that private communication if it's possible. So it's really using some of your own personal judgment to sort of figure out, like, what's the balance there between ensuring the health and safety of the individual, but as well making sure they're able to understand and communicate choices that are happening to them.
Excusing somebody from an exam room for a few minutes to ask a sensitive question isn't the same thing as excluding their support from the whole visit, too.
Yeah, as long as the person understands the sensitive question they're being asked, right?
Right.
And are able to communicate back their answer. So, you know, that's where the rapport, you have to have a rapport with people.
Right. And you can also have more than one supporter. Because maybe I want my mother to make most healthcare decisions, but if you're going to ask me about sex, then I want a different supporter.
Right.
How do you recommend that parents, how do you deal with parents who don't allow their young adult to practice decision making?
I'm going to let Vivian answer that.
Yeah, I think from the provider side, I think one of the things is centering them on the visit, making sure you're asking questions and directing it towards them, and encouraging the parents to not answer for their adult child if that's what their communication capacity is, encouraging them to seek. And it, again, if they're not verbal and they use alternative communication methods, encouraging the parents to explore those options to allow the adult child to practice decision-making. I think it also goes to encouraging parents to allow them to practice supported decision-making in other aspects of life as well, and allow them to prepare to make healthcare decisions. No one person wakes up one day and is instantly able to make healthcare decisions for themselves. I was not able to, you weren't able to, no one can do that. And it comes with practice, and it also comes with them understanding what their health situation is like too. So it's a big thing to encourage parents to involve their child in these decisions, encourage them to let them understand what their healthcare needs are from the youngest age possible so that they can practice it into adulthood, and letting them know, again, what their healthcare needs are so that they can stay informed and they can be a part of it. A lot of times we see situations where parents want to take over the decision-making for their adult child, or not let them talk about sensitive health care information, or are worried about them knowing about it. But if they don't understand what their health situation looks like, they aren't able to participate and communicate in there. So I think, again, it's really centering them in the visit, prompting questions to the individual rather than to the parents and encouraging that conversation.
Thank you so much for this talk and for everything that you're doing to help teach people. We're really talking about changing the nature of how people interact with their own family members and with the most important professionals in their lives. And it's going to take time. This is, I think, a generational project in terms of changing attitudes and relationships and points of view, a lot of modeling to go. And you've done a lot to help move us forward.
Thank you. Thank you for an amazing conference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.